trip to Paris. I saw the Eiffel Tower. I flew to Honolulu. It's a South Pacific power. I traveled way to Burma, all across the Bay of Biscay. I went to old Malaya. What a perfect locale. Traveled here and yonder, and I never found a home. I guess it must be written all my life to roam. On the river, they call the night.
Uhuru, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we have a very, very exciting show for you today. But before we go into the show, I wanted to thank two people that I thank every week. I would like to thank, first of all, O'Malley Ishatella for providing me the space on Uhuru Radio to do what I do. And I also would like to thank Archie Shep, a young man like Chairman O'Malley from Florida. And Archie Shep came up with the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West but not of the West. And I basically borrowed that from Brother Archie. And on today's show, we're going to be paying tribute to Gerald Levert, the son of Eddie Levert, the lead singer of the OJs. We're also going to be interviewing Toronto music maker Archie Aileen, who is a drummer and an educator. He is a veteran, seasoned veteran of the music scene here in Toronto. He also played with Billie Holiday, among other people. And we're also going to be speaking to Abdellah Abdir Razak, who is formerly James 67X Shabazz, or James Warden, and he is interviewed in Manny Marable's book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, and we're going to be talking to him. We did an interview with him earlier, and we're going to be running about half an hour of that interview. And also, we're going to just be playing some great, great music. We're going to be playing some music from Senegal, some music from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and some music from all over the world. And if you wanted to get a hold of us, you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com, or if you want to do the Skype thing, if you're in the 21st century, you can do that by just going to Uhuru Radio. And if you want to make a phone call from North America, you can go to 727-565-1599. And if you're in the UK, the United Kingdom, you can call 020-8133-6629. And Diasporic Music continues with the Spinners.
You and me, we're going out, catch a lady's eye, guaranteed to blow your mind so high you won't come down.
Hey y'all, prepare yourself for the rubber band. Man, you never heard a sound like the rubber band. Man, you're bound to lose control when the rubber band starts to jam. To hear him play at a club outside of town, I was so surprised. I was hypnotized. Sound this cat put down. When I saw this short black guy place a band between his toes, hey, I laughed so hard, cause the man got down when it finally reached his nose. Guaranteed to blow your mind. Then all the music get keeping time. On the world, did he learn that? Oh Lord, huh?
You never heard a sound. You never seen him move. You are
of stuff do we think we can stand? So much rhythm, grace, debonair for one man. Oh, no. And then he had a nerve to wiggle his left to the night. And then he got a feeling in his head, y'all. How does he do it, y'all? Come on and do it. Do that rubber band.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we were listening to the music of Yusu Endure and the Spinners, and they did Rubber Band Man. And the Rubber Band Man was a composition by Tom Bell was actually born in Kingston, Jamaica, but he grew up in Philadelphia. And Yusu Endure is a great musician out of Senegal. He's a Wolof, and I happen to be the first African in the Western Hemisphere to interview Yusu Endure. Yusu Endure was touring with Peter Gabriel, and I have a tape of him actually saying that I was the first black person that he had spoke to in the Western Hemisphere. And the Rubber Band Man was also composed by Linda Creed, the late Linda Creed, and Tom Bell. And the Spinners did the first rendition of Rubber Band Man, and they featured at that time Purvis Jackson with the bass voice. Purvis is no longer in the land of the living. Billy Henderson, he is no longer in the land of the living. Felipe Wynn, he's no longer in the land of the living. And the two living spinners are Henry Frambrough and Bobby Smith. And you can see them really in action if you go to see that film Rumble in the Jungle. And they performed in, at that time it was Zaire, did a very great job of performing on the motherland. And Diasporic Music is going to continue. We're going to take you to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and we're going to be listening to a young man by the name of Papa Wemba.
I keep saying Norman, you're on. Norman?
Big boy. Yes.
You're on.
You have another song that Otis Redding's going to play, right?
Otis?
Yep.
You're on.
You're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. We were listening to the music of Otis Redding and Papa Wemba. Otis Redding out of Georgia and Papa Wemba out of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And Papa Wemba did a lot of some cover versions of music of African people in the Western Hemisphere, but he did his own thing. I just wanted to play, show you the contrast between how some African musicians on the African continent appreciate Africans in the Western Hemisphere. And Otis Redding was a very, very great businessman, and he always got his money up front, apparently. He traveled with his own security, and he was known to always get his money and not with a lawyer either. And he was, we read Muhammad Speaks newspaper and was, I don't know if he was going to join the Nation of Islam. I'm not going to go that far, but he was trying to, attempting to start a black musicians union. And many people feel that this is the reason he met an early demise. He was killed in a plane crash in 1967. And we're going to continue Diasporic Music with a young man who just turned 70 years old, a man who used to live in Mississauga, Ontario, and he saw the mothership on the 401 here in Toronto, and this man is none other than George Clinton.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. But the dog that chases its tail will be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, stick dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, kind of dog, funky dog. Nasty dog.
And you're listening to Uhuru Radio. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And we were listening to the music of George Clinton, who just turned 70 years of age on a couple of days ago. And George Clinton one time lived here in the city of Toronto, or more, I guess to be accurate, he lived in Mississauga. And he had a couple of children that were born here, Barbarella. I think Barbarella might be in Atlanta, Georgia right now, but George Clinton spent many, many, many years in Toronto, Canada. And joining me on the line from Toronto is Archie Eileen, who is an educator and a veteran drummer, musician, and an entrepreneur. He is born and reared here in the city of Toronto of a Bajan father. Let's put it that way. And Archie Aline, how are you doing today?
Not too bad, Norman Otis. Nice to hear you again.
I guess we wanted to talk to you about, you have been in the music business. We look to you as like the elder statesman of the music business here in Toronto. But before we go into that, I wanted to get you to talk about what is Archie Aline doing in 2011. You know, what activities you're involved in other than the scholarship fund? We'll talk about that later.
Well, basically, I'm spending most of my time with the scholarship fund and mentoring the young African-Canadian musicians here that most of them are going to Humber College, and just trying to keep keep the jazz alive, you know, which is the only recognized art form in the U.S. of A. When people aren't aware of that fact. And what's happening now is it's being lost. Children not picking up instruments anymore, and they're getting CD record players and spinning them and dancing, which is fine because it's part of the social development that's going on in the modern day and age. But we can't forget our roots, you know, and jazz is our roots. It's the only recognized American in America art form in America, you know. We can't lose that. We can't give it away like we do everything else.
In terms of the music that we know as jazz, how did you get involved in it in living in Toronto, Canada? What was the scene like when you were growing up?
Oh, there's always jazz. So, you know, during the period when I grew up, of course, Duke Ellington was quite it still is one of the most recognized and well-respected musicians in everybody's world, and the jazz was always prevalent in all the black homes because that was our music. My mother used to play it, my dad played it, my grandmother played it, and that's how I was born. I was raised with the jazz, and it's the one music that I enjoyed because it was inbred. You know, it was wonderful.
How much influence was blues and gospel on you as an individual, Archie Aline?
Well, blues was, but the gospel is a little different here in Toronto at that time. It wasn't like the gospel is now. There wasn't that much rhythm. I don't want to get into that scenario about that right now, but the blues was quite prevalent, you know, because the blues is basically the foundation of jazz. It was basically came before jazz, you know, so. And it's all black music, and regardless of when it was done, it's still there. It's always going to be there. But if our youth don't start picking up on it, we're going to lose it, which we are starting to do now.
In terms of when you were growing up, was there very many blues performers in the city of Toronto? I know now we have Harrison Kennedy, who is out of Hamilton. He went on to perform with the chairman of the board, but he is actually, as an African-Canadian, keeping the blues alive in the Canadian context. When you were coming up, were there people, black people doing blues?
Oh yeah, we had a lot of blues singers here at the time. You know the UNIA Hall, United Negro Improvement Association, which is 355 College Street. You know, P55, the Land of Dry, Please for Happy Feet, we called it. You know, that was establishment for us, it was our community center, was established by Marcus Garvey way back when. And there was always blues going on. We had weekend dances, there was lots of blues. We had sessions on Sunday where a lot of local musicians came up and the vocalists and had Sunday sessions all day, all afternoon, you know. So it was happening here, but not as much as it probably would be in the States because the black population here wasn't as large as it is down there. We probably had about during the 30s, we had, probably 1,000 black families here. I could be exaggerating, you know, but the black community was quite small. As a matter of fact, we were situated in the Kensington Market area, which was between Spadina and College and Bathurst and Dundas, right? And that, as a matter of fact, that's where I'm talking to you from now, because it's the Jews and the blacks. We all live together in extreme harmony, because we were minorities and nobody really wanted to pay any attention to us. But we weren't a threat because there weren't that many of us here. But
right.
That's where I'm sitting now. I'm having breakfast in one of the little restaurants on Baldwin Street, Baldwin and Augustus.
Baldwin and Augustus, you went on to... Well, I'm speaking with Archie Eileen, who is an educator. He leads a group called Collage. He's a drummer. And at one point, you had a famous restaurant called the Underground Railroad. And I remember going in there with Donald Byrd. I mean, you had some of the people. Everybody came through the Underground Railroad. Could you talk about that experience?
Yeah, well, we did that 1968-69. And it was in a real soul food restaurant, and we had a 13-year run. And any black performers that came into town and any tourists that came into town, they all came to the Underground Real Soul Food restaurant rather than go to McDonald's and Burger King and all that. You know, they went there only to save money. But when they came to our place, yeah, we weren't expensive, but at least they could get some real food. You know, we had ham hocks and barbecued ribs. And our ham hocks were so big, we didn't have the ankle, we had the hock. So big that people used to take a picture of it before they ate it, you know. They thought they had the whole pig, you know. So it's a great spot. Everyone was there, man. And we had, Bill Cosby was a good friend of ours. And he came in, whenever he was performing in town, he would always come by with an entourage of followers, you know. And everyone was in. Sarah Vaughan was in, and who else did I have in? Joe Williams, all of them, and they all knew me because I'm in the music industry, and so they knew where I was. And it was actually pleasurable that we were able to give them the kind of cuisine that they're accustomed to. You know.
Well, you know, I found a photograph did a Google search, and I found a beautiful picture with you and Billie Holiday, and I put that up on the internet, and people absolutely went insane when they saw you with Lady Day.
Oh, that was 1957, and she was Mel Waldron was her traveling pianist at that time, and
Mel
we were
Waldron,
working
right?
in Stratford. Yeah,
right.
You know the Shaw Festival in Stratford. Well, they
yes,
had a jazz series going on there, and from Stratford, she was going to the Town Tavern, where I was resident drummer for 13 years, and so it was only appropriate that I accompany her in Stratford. And then we went to the Town Tavern, and we were there for a week, which was just absolutely wonderful. The place was packed every night. As a matter of fact, I'll give you a little story. This was a Saturday night, you know, and here it's the loudest and noisiest time of the week for entertainers. And, you know, I was playing, I had my eyes closed, and I was playing, and she was singing one of her signature tunes, which was God Bless the Child. And
mm-hmm.
I had my eyes closed, and all of a sudden it was dead, so quiet. Man, what happened? So I opened my eyes and looked around. The waiters stopped serving. The people at the bar stopped drinking. The kitchen staff came out and stood there, and I said, man, how about that for demanding attention? And it was just eerie. You know, seriously, shut the place out there. It was wonderful. But it's a great experience with her. What a wonderful woman she was.
But in terms of a bar to stop selling, for that is definitely ultimate respect, I guess, for a musician.
Exactly. It's just for that one tune, you know, it was probably run about 5 minutes or so. But it was a deadly 5 minutes, you know.
Right. You mentioned Stratford. I think that I say you mentioned Stratford isn't for lack of a better for anything else to say. I think Justin Bieber's from Stratford, isn't he?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't pay any attention to them. I don't pay any attention to them. The only young youth group I have ever paid attention to is the Jacksons, man. The rest of it ain't happening for me. That's nothing going on there.
Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. I know you were into them.
And the who?
Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, they were before the Jacksons. They were a good group.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not familiar with them either, you know, because I was mostly on the jazz scene, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to study my jazz, and it took a lot of work and a lot of staying up all night and hanging out and doing all the illicit things that we do, you know. And that was just great.
Well, could you talk a little bit about Collage? And you have a group, current group called Collage, and I know that you formed Collage with the late Doug Richardson. Doug Richardson, we've talked about him before on the Hoover Radio, but Doug Richardson was a great saxophonist, played the flute.
Yeah, tenor saxophone, yeah. Well, Doug and I grew up together down here in the Kensington Market area, Dundas and Spadina, which was the black community. Not community, by the way, but most of the black community survived and lived. And so Dougie came back from L.A., and I said, we got to put a black group together because they don't have any here. So I put the group together along with Dougie, and so it was a hard bop group, and we still have a hard bop group because that music is disappearing. And that music was created during the golden era of jazz by all the black musicians that were out there, Art Blakey and Hank Mobley and Lee Morgan, and, you know, and we can just go on and on. You know who they are. And we're losing that, man. I say hard bop to some of these kids out here, and they say, what? Hard bop? What is it made out of rocks or something? I said, no, it's music that you have to listen to, and it's one of the reasons why you're able to get into the industry today. If it weren't for us, you'd have nothing, you know. So it's a good group. We did extremely well. We won a couple of awards, and which was just fine. We've done 4 CDs. I'm getting ready to do another one this year, which I hope to have done by the fall with my new Collage. I put a new band together. So I had another song. I'm going to change up the direction of the music. Dougie always had a wonderful saying about some of the music we did. He says, a lot of the music that's out there, so he says, where's the romance, man? There's no more romance in our music, you know? So I'm going to put together some... No more romance, man. It's all hard stuff and everybody fighting one another and not liking anybody and that. So I'm not, my new CD is going to have to... It's going to deal with romance and stuff like Benny Goldson did, that has done, which is, you know, Whisper Not and stuff like that with some mutes and nice, easy tempo. My theory is that if you can't sing the song after you've heard it, then it ain't nothing happening. You know, it's something you got to take away with you, you know.
Right. Now, Benny
Goldson, what's happening with that.
Benny Goldson is out of Philly. He was one of the jazz messengers, but he's still in the land of the living, and he wrote some beautiful music, Killer Joe and things like that, right?
Of course he did. And a wonderful music, man. And you don't hear too much of that anymore, you know. There was one time, I used to tell a lot of young kids here, there was one time you could put a record on through the 50s and through the 60s and part of the 70s, and you don't tell me who it is, I'll tell you each player on that record, because they all were individuals and that were able to play music that we would never forget. You could tell by their sound and how they play, but nowadays everybody sounds the same, you know. I talked to a flute tail player here that I know, and he was playing with Jimmy Cobb up at the top of the center. He said, man, he said, Jimmy Cobb, man, it's just fantastic. He said, where's all the drummers? Why aren't they up here listening to him? He says, because all the drummers that I hear now, they all sound like they're falling down the stairs, you know, with a set of drums. So, that's really a great statement, because a lot of us, they do, man, too busy. They're all over the place. They ain't playing the drums, they're playing tricks, you know, and it's not, some of it's not very musical. My opinion. That doesn't necessarily mean that's right, you know.
But, you know, Jimmy Cobb spent a lot of time here in Toronto, and he played with, played with Wynton Kelly, yeah, on Naima. Played with Cannonball for a long time. Is there anything
right.
else you would like to add? Because we're going to play an interview that you did with Ross Porter, and I want to let you go because I know you're in a meeting, so I don't want to take up any more of your time. But is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, just to keep in mind, you know, I do have the scholarship fund, and I have a beautiful, beautiful event coming up September the 18th. At the this is uncanny. It's going to be at the L. Green Miles Nadel JCC, which is the Jewish Community Center. And I'm using my Evolution of Jazz Ensemble, which is 9 pieces of young black musicians that have come out of Humber College. I have graduated from Humber College. That's for the first portion with a photo exhibition of all the earlier black musicians that were in Toronto that nobody even talks about anymore. But I have the photos. I've been collecting them for 25 years. And then for the second portion of the show, I have some of the senior local musicians that will play will be playing, along with Jackie Richardson, one of my features, Kelly Lee Evans, who just won a Juno for her new CD, Nina, dedicated to Nina Simone, and Jay Jackson, who were the first young black couple to have, sister and brother, to have a television show of their own here at CBC. And also a tap dancer, Sean Byfield, one of the best tap dancers around, along with a young lady, Janae Upshaw, who is a member of the Upshaw family here in Toronto. It's one of the more popular families. So it's going to be a great show, and it's to raise some money so I can keep supporting all the young musicians in my community that want to go to school and that kind of afford it. So up to date, I've given 17 bursaries and scholarships up to today, and this is within a little within 8 years. So I'm quite proud of it, and I'm presenting another scholarship to, you know, Eddie Bullen.
Eddie Bullen, great pianist, right?
Yeah. Well, his son Quincy is now with my ensemble, the youth ensemble, and I'm going to give him a bursary at the event to put him in the Humber College, so he can expand on his music abilities.
Yes.
So that's pretty well it, you know. So everybody can keep in touch and keep track of me by going into my website, which you have, which is collage, KOLLAGE.ca, and also my scholarship fund website, AASF.ca, which stands for the Archeolian Scholarship Fund. So that's it, and I'm trying to keep our music alive, and I'm trying to keep it in the community, because all they're doing is looking at these dollar bills, and dollar bills does not have anything to do with the community except either make you rich or poor.
All right, sir, and thank you for your time, and I'll let you go back to your meeting, and we will talk to you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Norman Otis Richmond, and we'll hook up soon.
Yes, sir. And
bye-bye.
You have been listening to Archie Aileen, who is an educator and a drummer and an entrepreneur here in the city of Toronto, Canada. And right now we wanted to listen to an interview that Archie Aileen did with Ross Porter, and he's going to talk about more details about his scholarship fund. This is Archie Aileen and Ross Porter.
Hi, I'm Ross Porter, and I'm the president of Jazz FM 91 here in Toronto. And my guest is Archie Aileen. Archie is a renowned musician and also the head of the Archie Aileen Scholarship Fund. Archie, you've been doing this for, 50 years now?
Actually, 62, Ross.
What is it you like about playing music?
Basically, what I like playing music is I don't have to work during the day. I have to look for work, which was basically the origins of my getting into the music business, and there not being enough work around. So I got into the music industry, and as I said, it's been 62 years now, and I have been quite successful as far as I am concerned, and it's now time to give back. And there's still a lot of young musicians in my community that are still having a bit of a difficult time getting out into the industry, as the industry is getting smaller, not enough venues, and it's giving me the opportunity to help them perhaps pursue the industry as best they can by helping them out financially, and it's such a wonderful, rewarding feeling.
And if people are interested in participating in your scholarship fund, what do they need to know?
The purpose of this scholarship fund is to give a lot of the younger people the opportunity to pursue it in its fullest and to study the program at Humber College. And most of the young musicians with me now, especially the EOJ, which is the Evolution of Jazz Ensemble, give them the opportunity to continue on and to learn and to become professional musicians. And I need to help them. Nobody else is taking them into consideration. I feel myself as being one of the senior members of the music industry on a whole, still working and still very concerned about the youth that are coming up, especially in my community. And the more I can help them, the better it's going to help the industry itself, and it's going to give them some kind of ownership as to what the industry has to offer.
So if people are watching this on the website now,
yes,
they can get more information on the website. Is there an application that they can download?
Well, there certainly is. There's an application on there. It's called the AASF, the Archie Aileen Scholarship Fund. Download it, answer the questions, send it into the box number that is there. We'll take a look at it with the rest of my committee, and if it's worthwhile, we feel they need some assistance, we will help them. And that, of course, is on my website, which is collage, spelled with a K, OLLAGE.ca. There will be a link to that, too, which will be AASF.ca. And if they go to that link, they will be extremely surprised. It's going to be one of the finest links that anyone has ever seen, or probably will ever see,
okay.
Especially with me being on it.
I couldn't agree more. Archie, thanks very much.
And thank you, Ross. Thank you for everything you have done
and
everything that you're going to be doing for the jazz community. We need you.
My guest has been Archie Ely.
To Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we have just had a discussion with Archie Aileen, who is an educator and a drummer and an entrepreneur based here in the city of Toronto. And now we're going to shine the spotlight on Gerald Levert, who is the son of Eddie Levert. And Gerald Levert, we're going to also hear from Rick James and Tina Marie. And we're going to be playing a lot of music from the OJs. And we're going to have, this is going to be a good set. But Rick James lived here in the city of Toronto. And Gerald is going to talk about Rick James a little bit later. But right now we're going to listen to Rick James and Tina Marie.
Wow. It's really good to see you again, baby. And I must admit, you're looking very, very, very nice these days. I guess life must be treating you well. Oh, me? Well, I've just been doing the same old thing I've always been doing, you know. I've got a new lady now, and it's a little different than it was when I was with you. You know, I think back to when we met, the way I used to be and the cold way I used to act. But more than that, I think of how you changed me with your love and sensitivity. Remember when I used to
pleasure. that was my claim to fame. With every measure, tasted your teardrop stains, yeah.
You were cold as ice. Ooh. Long ago.
We both say a little too much today.
No.
After all, T, you're kind of with somebody and I'm kind of living with somebody. But please do me a favor just before you go. Just put your arms around me and hold me like you used to.
I will hold you tight.
Can you call her rose? by Rick James. Rick James.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we have been listening to the music of Gerald Levert and Tina Marie. We're also listening to the music of Rick James and Tina Marie. And during this half an hour, we're shining the spotlight on the late Gerald Levert, who passed away in 2006 at the age of 40. And Gerald Levert is the son, one of the sons of Eddie Levert, the lead vocalist of the OJs. And Gerald had a group called Levert, and Gerald blossomed into a great producer. And I know you remember the song Practice What You Preach by Barry White. That was Gerald Levert's handiwork. And we are paying tribute to Gerald during this half an hour. And Gerald Levert talks about how Rick James, who lived here in Toronto, Canada for many, 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 many years, and lived in Los Angeles and lived in Buffalo, and I had some dealings with Rick James, and Rick James was I really like Rick James. I had a lot of good times with Rick James, and I want to do a whole segment on Rick James, but this is Gerald Levert's segment, so we're going to basically let Gerald Levert talk about how his father, Eddie Levert, influenced Rick James.
About Rick James. Rick James was a big Eddie Levert fan. Now, you got to realize, Rick James came out of Buffalo and through Cleveland and would be here when they played Leo's Casino. Now, me and Rick used to talk about this too, man. God bless his soul. Hey, everybody gone. But it's like, Rick was, whenever I'd see him, he would come up to me, just the meaning of, it was a song the Jays did a long time, I'm like a shadow,
standing
for love, oh, it's all right, and if you listen to Rick, love them and leave them, that's what I used to do. That's all Eddie Levert, if you really think about it. And the funny thing, when I was younger, and they used to be doing those jazz festivals and all that stuff, my dad used to come home, and I was like, man, that Rick James is hot, you know, times. Yeah, but he's stealing my stuff. He's stealing my stuff, and I don't like that. He's always coming in my room asking me how to do this, and I keep telling him. And then I guess one night, it was a night Rick didn't want to follow the Jays because he was closing the show, and he wanted to switch off. And my dad said, well, you give me your money, and then we'll switch.
We're going to do a tune, and the name of the tune is Standing for Love. And like every time I do something that you like, I want to hear you scream, holler, raise your hand, anything. All right? All right. It goes something like this. Baby,
seen many a girl's, but none for me. Oh, I'm like the lonely sailor out on the open sea.
One thing I want to ask you right here, you know? I just want to ask one thing now. If what I ask you, if it touches somewhere, I want you to raise your hand, you know. I either scream or do something. Now, I want you to tell me the truth, because I'm going to raise my hand, because it can't be nothing but true. You understand? All right, now.
I've seen many a girls, but none for me. Oh, I'm like the lonely sailor out on the open sea.
I'm telling you now, like I told you before.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and we are paying tribute to Gerald Levert, and we're listening to the music, we have been listening to some of the music that Gerald Levert did, and some of the music, we're also playing some of the music of the OJs. And Gerald Levert is the son of Eddie Levert, the co-leader of the OJs. We have paid tribute to Walter Williams, and Walter Williams was the co-leader of the OJs. But most people, when they think, not I shouldn't say most people, but many people, when they think about the OJs, they think about Eddie LaVert, because Eddie LaVert, I guess, is the most aggressive of the two singers. But we were listening to, we heard the song, Oh, How You Hurt Me, Girl, which was led by William Powell, the late William Powell. William Powell passed away in 1977. We also heard from, Walter Williams singing Lipstick Traces. We also heard Lonely Drifter and Stand In for Love. Those were led by Eddie LaVert. And right now we're going to go to Gerald and Eddie LaVert singing together. This is Gerald LaVert and his father, Eddie LaVert.
Ooh.
His mother's Jamaican. Uhuru, you're listening to Dice for Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis. We were listening to the music of Eddie LaVert and his son, Gerald LaVert, and we have been shining the spotlight on Gerald. And that concludes today's musical tributes. And we're going to go out with an interview that we did recently with a man that was Malcolm X's aide. He was Malcolm X's personal secretary. His name is Abdullah Abdur Razak, James 67X Warden, or James 67X Shabazz. And he basically is very upset at the publication of Manny Marable's book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. And we're going to listen to Brother Abdullah. But first, I would like to thank Keisha Bolton for teching today's show. I would also like to thank Naya Binga Zimbabwe and Jesse Neville Alexander. But Keisha did the bulk of the work, and I would like to thank her. And we're going to close with an interview with Brother Abdullah.
This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, in Toronto, Canada, speaking with Abdur Razak.
Correct.
And he's formerly known as James 67X Shabazz, and he was Malcolm X's personal secretary. And we wanted to discuss the new book by Manny Marable, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. And I guess, first of all, people wanted to know, what was your relationship with Malik Shabazz, Malik El Shabazz?
A lot will depend on what period of time you're speaking of. When I was in the Nation of Islam, I was a lieutenant in the Nation of Islam, and under Captain Joseph, who was under Brother Minister Malcolm. Then I became the circulation manager of the Muhammad Street newspaper for New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. So I was directly under the aegis of Brother Malcolm. Then when the split came between him and the Nation of Islam, he made me the captain of the men in the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. But I also acted as his man Friday and then the press releases. He was out of the country for a month, so I ran the store, so to speak. I was a signer of the corporation papers of Mr. Mark Incorporated, and I also signed for the corporation papers of the Organization of African-American Unity. And I did whatever he told me to do. That's about it.
Now, how and when did you meet Minister Malcolm?
Well, I had heard about him, and someone inveigled me in going to March number 7, but I thought they were kind of crazy people down there. So I didn't want to go, but I promised someone I would go, so I went. And I didn't hear Brother Malcolm. I heard the man who became the Farrakhan. And he frightened me quite a bit. And I went back and heard a Minister Henry speak, who became the minister of Mosque number 29 in Miami, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
The next time I went, I had to go three or four times before I heard Brother Malcolm. And I argued with him. I couldn't understand how someone could call white people the devil. I acknowledged that we caught heck at their hands, but I couldn't understand why he called him the devil. And he was very professorial, had a unique command of the language, never got offended by a question that was asked.
And to make a long story short, I went for 9 months every Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I heard this teaching, and I eventually joined or went into the Nation or accepted the teaching as was being taught. Then he started giving me assignments to do this or do that. And we had a saying in the Nation that there will be men in the ranks who will stay in the ranks. Why? I'll tell you why. Simply because they do not have the ability to get things done. And Brother Minister Malcolm at the time saw me as a man who could get things done, so he asked me to do things, and I did them. And that's about the size of it. I became the circulation manager of the newspaper. And now my responsibility shifted from Captain Joseph, who was my superior as a lieutenant, he was a captain. But now, as the circulation manager, I became what was called in the Nation a laborer. As a lieutenant, I was an official, but I received no pay for that. Once I became circulation manager of the newspaper, I became a laborer and was put on salary. So now I was directly responsible to Brother Malcolm rather than Captain Joseph. And I got to know him pretty well. And I was amazed. I had thought myself a pretty smart individual because I always did well academically. But he really shocked me with his perception, his mental agility, his command of the language, his knowledge of history and so many other things, but particularly his knowledge of human nature and his ability to discern things that had escaped me. And so I became a great admirer of his, and I found him the first man descended from slaves that I really admired who was not a musician or an athlete. And to this day, I am still held in awe by his perception, his mental ability, his forensic ability to speak on any level with anyone about almost anything, and his totally individual personal focus upon the problem of the people in America who were descended from slaves.
But your father, pardon me, I don't want to cut you, but your father was, you didn't come from, you're an educated man, but you were a degreed man and speak several languages and so on and so forth. Could you talk about your education? Your education, and then Malcolm, who was, I think they said he only had an eighth grade education, he impressed you so much.
Well, he impressed me because as a youngster, I had a rather, they tell me, other people say, they say the eye sees not itself but by reflection in some other thing. So it's often what someone else tells you about yourself that becomes part of your evaluation, self-evaluation. And I was told by many, many, many people that I had an astounding memory. And I equated memory with intelligence. And it is can be a function of intelligence. But I found out that I could go into almost any class and sit down and remember what the teacher said, and what they called intelligence was your ability to repeat what the teacher said, to regurgitate what the teacher said. So as a result, when I took nationwide examinations, I did very, very, very well. And so I considered myself, measured by the standards that prevailed in the society in which I was, I considered myself very intelligent. But then I met Brother Malcolm, and he had what I considered true intelligence. And that's what made him able to debate with almost anyone and demolish them, because he was not depending upon memory. He was depending on a perception that he had. He was like a man who was looking at the heavens through a telescope, and everybody else was looking at it through their naked eyes. So he saw a whole lot more than I saw. And was very, very perceptive and was totally devoted to what he did. I can't, it's very, very difficult to explain. And he was religious. I tell people, and it offends most, I only met two religious people in my life. They were Malcolm and a fellow that I was in the army with, a Jewish fellow named Leon Alvo. They were religious. They believed. They believed. They didn't believe. They knew. There's a the language is there's a paucity in the language, because when people know something, it's stronger than believing something. You know, I can't. It's very difficult to really explain, because I find that the language is incapable of really describing Malcolm as he was. He was so perceptive. He made me feel stupid so many times. I said, Jesus Christ, how did you graduate from school cum laude and be as dumb as you are? And how did this guy in prison get a mind that was like a well-oiled... The words failed me. I have never, in the 40-some years after his execution, I have never been able to satisfactorily explain what a total human being and masculine human being. He exemplified what in any country of the world would be considered the stature of a man, of a male, of a man. This was a man. If he said something, he meant it. I'm going to tell you, just not to offend you, I was very annoyed just now because it was 8 minutes after eight.
And I know, because you have to have a watch. You have to live by a watch, right? I knew.
But Malcolm, listen, Malcolm was never late for anything, to my knowledge. He scorned anybody that was not on time. Now, that sounds like a simple thing, but I challenge anybody descended from chattel slaves, be on time for everything for a month. See if you can do it. It's almost impossible. And it's greatly possible, but we have been trained to be late. That's part of our makeup. And that's why they use the word CP time, colored people's time. Oh, you know, sooner or later you'll get here.
West Indian, WI time, West Indian time, UN time. I was at the UN, and the only person that showed up on time was me and a guy from East Germany, when Germany was a socialist country. We showed up on time, but he laughed and said, "Well," I said, "I heard of like CP time, West Indian time." He says, "Well, brother, you are." He didn't say brother, but he says, "You know, getting ready for UN time, because we don't start." It was a committee against apartheid. It was, you know, and it was mostly us and a few Eastern European countries. So
yeah,
I appreciate what you're saying.
Well, Malcolm was on time, brother. He was on time, and if you came in 4 minutes late, man, he looked at you with a look, brother, that could burn your skin. I learned how to be on time in dealing with him. And I'll be honest with you, I have fallen right back to the same old CP time, but I judge other people the way he judges me. So I'm saying that in a left-handed way of apologizing. I'm late. Sometimes. The first thing, the 40th anniversary of his execution, the A train was not working here in New York, so I had to take the C train. I got there 14 minutes late, man. Just looking at his statue made me shake a little bit. He was alive, I'd have it now, you know. So.
But I'm speaking to Abdullah Razak, and I wanted to ask you...
Okay. Abdul Razak is my last name. Abdullah Abdul Razak.
Okay.
Let's not dwell on that, but I'd like to get it right so people know who you're talking about. You got so many people with Muslim names today, you could be talking about somebody else.
So you don't use the name James 67 X Shabazz anymore?
No, I didn't never use the word James 67 X Shabazz. I was James 67 X Warden. Warden was my slave name.
Right.
So when you went into the nation, you put an X between the name your mother gave you and your slave, and the name that was used by the people who owned you during slavery. Most of the people who are descended from slaves in America that come from after, that originated in Africa, they don't have names. They think it's their name, but that's the name of the person that owned you during slavery. So we said, no, we're no longer slaves. So we put an X. So I was James Monroe King Warden. And then I became the 67th James in Mosque number 7, whose mother had named me James. So I became James 67 X Warden. No longer Warden. Warden don't own me anymore. he used to own me, but he doesn't own me anymore. And when Malcolm broke with the Nation, or the Nation broke with Malcolm, to speak to reporters and say, you're speaking to JN67X, that created a lot of confusion. So he said, from now on, call yourself James Shabazz. Well, Shabazz, according to Mr. the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Shabazz was a tribe to which all of us belonged, the tribe of Shabazz, the lost found nation of Islam in the wilderness of North America that was lost and now found. And he said that the Bible thing about Joseph being sold into slavery and the prodigal son were all about us. And so when the good father said, the prodigal son returned home, the good father said, my son who was lost is now found. Bring out the fatted bullock, for the son who was lost is now found and returned to the fold. So Mr. Muhammad said that that was a biblical description of us who had been kidnapped and sold into slavery by our brothers like Joseph, brought into the wilderness of North America 10,000 miles on a slow westerly course and buried at the North Gate. So we considered ourselves, all of us could use the name Shabazz because we were from the tribe of Shabazz. I was just going to say, so that's why I started using the name Shabazz. But then I came out of the Nation. I was put out of the Nation. And I wanted a name. I took care of a man named Sheikh Ahmed Hassoun from Khartoum and Omdurman, and who had a gate at the holy city of Mecca. And he wanted to name me Mu'min, meaning the trustworthy one. And I said to myself, well, if I didn't want the European to name me, why should I want somebody from the Sudan to name me?
Right.
Because what I want is a name that is consistent with the nature of my father that I find he transmitted to me genetically. And my father was not an extraordinarily affectionate man, but he was a provider. And I am not what you would call a romantic, but I believe in a relationship with a wife and a husband that I have a responsibility to feed her, to clothe her, to shelter her, and to do the same for my children. So I am a provider. So in the Arabic language, in the Islamic cosmology, God has 99 different attributes. He is Allah, Ar-Rahman, Al-Malik, Al-Qudus, As-Salam, etc., etc., etc. There are 99 attributes, and the 18th attribute of God is Razaka, he who provides. So I took the name Abdul Razak, meaning I am one who provides for his family, regardless to whom, regardless of what, I'm going to take care of my family. So that's how I took the name Abdullah Abdul Razak. Abdullah is a construct. Abdul means slave. Abdul Allahi means the servant or slave of God. And I made up my mind, I am not being the servant or slave of anybody except God. So I took the name Abdullah Abdul Razak. That's how I got this name. And I didn't do it by court order. I had to go to war with the State Department. that's another story.
That's another story. Because I wanted to go into your thoughts on Manny Marable's book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. And everybody is, well, I guess there's two camps. One camp has seen this as the greatest book about Malcolm that was ever, you know, put on paper, and the other camp, and many of the people that were interviewed by Manny Marable, the late Manny Marable, say that they were misquoted. So I wanted you basically to talk about what happened when you met with Manny Marable, and how what are some of the things that he didn't put in there, or he did put in there that you don't appreciate?
Well, it's not a case of really appreciation. It's a case of, is something factual or is it non-factual? Is it what I said, or did I say something that led him to conclusions that are completely unjustified by what I said? And I am rather fortunate in that I had a VHS made of 2 hours of our first interview, which took place in 2003, and for which I was paid. I was paid $600 by the Malcolm X Project to do this. He sought me out. I did not see him. I've never heard of the man before in my life. That was in 2003, and I have a copy of that interview. Then in 2008, he contacted me again and asked me to come to Columbia on July 24th, which I did, and I was interviewed. This was not done visually. This was done by all cassette tape, and I got a transcript of that interview, and he asked me to come back the next week, which was August 1st, and I have a transcript of that tape. Then he interviewed someone that I recommended in Jacksonville, Florida, and I have that entire transcript. And he made factual errors that were so ridiculous that I couldn't believe it, because I had heard that the man had written 15 books. So I assumed, well, finally we're going to get the, and the book had been heralded as, this is going to be the definitive book about Brother Malcolm. Well, another fellow named Bruce Perry did the same thing. And he filled the book with psychobabble, so that I would have never, if you didn't use the name Malcolm X, I would have never realized who he was writing the book about. Well, now, Manning Marable made some things, which I'm going to just tell you factually. First place, he has a man in there named Lukeman something. I'm not going to tell you his last name. And he put his name as Anas Lukeman, which his name is not Anas Lukeman. So I called him up and I asked him, did you give your name as Anas Lukeman? He said, no. I said, well, they got you in the book as Anas Lukeman. Okay. Then I went to Columbia University. I told him, and I have it on the original interview, I went to Columbia for 2 years. I went to the, I was a candidate for the master's degree in business administration, and I went to the East Asian Institute, where I was campaigning for a certificate. And I didn't take the final in math, in statistics, or accounting. So I didn't get the degree, although I went there. Okay. He puts in his book that I was a candidate for the master's degree in arts, MA. I wasn't a candidate for the MA. I was a candidate for the MBA. Then he says, and then, that I spoke fluent Japanese and 2 other languages fluently. That's not true. I never spoke fluent Japanese. I spoke good Japanese, but not fluent. And I,
right.
The point is, whether I spoke it fluently or not, I did not tell him that I spoke it fluently. I never told anyone that. Then he says, I left there in a huff because someone called me nigger. No one ever called me nigger at Columbia University. This is precisely what I told him. I said, I was in a management class, and they used the casebook method there. So the teacher, who was from Princeton, but I don't remember his name, he said, what we have to do in this case is find the nigger in the woodpile. So I didn't know what he meant. So after class, he walks over to me and he says, I guess I used an unfortunate choice of words. So I said, well, apparently it's good vernacular English. I'm the only one in the class who didn't know what you was talking about. So he still didn't explain it to me. Well, at the time, I associated with a young lady who was in one of my other classes. And we had a good rapport. So I asked her, I said, let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard the expression, nigger in the woodpile? She said, sure. So I said, what does it mean? So she said, that's somebody that should be out working, but instead they're up in the woodpile asleep. So I
yeah.
said, oh, I've never heard it before. So I said, do you have any other terms like that? So she said, yeah, white as a nigger's palm, shiny as a nigger's wheel, shiny as a nigger's heel. And she went on. So I said, my God. She said, you know what a nigger is, don't you? I said, what? She said, that colored gentleman that just left the room. I said, well, I'll be dipped in mud. Oh, this is going on around me, and I don't even know it, you know? So that's what I told him. And I subsequently, after this was not in the interview, But I never said that someone called me nigger at Columbia University, which he has in the book.
Right.
Subsequently, I read a book by Charles Blockson, who was the man who got me interested in genealogy, when I was at Temple, actually. And Muhammad Ahmed took me to this Blockson library, and I was given a book called Damn Rare, about rare books. He was a rare book collector. And he said, this is because this fascinates me, he said there was a man named Randolph in colonial America who was screwing his brother's wife. and she got pregnant. So now they got a problem to get rid of this baby. So she was getting rid of the baby in a woodpile, getting rid of the fetus. And they didn't know, but a slave woman was watching it. So they call her the nigger in the woodpile.
That's so, what it came.
Mr. Blockson says that they had a trial, and that Thomas Jefferson attended the trial to try some business. He didn't go into detail.